creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Today on Culture Click, we take you back to Ibsenfest 2014 for a presentation from Professor Mark Sandberg. Professor Sandberg is the current president of the Ibsen Society of America and a member of the International Ibsen Committee. We now take you to the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro, Minnesota for the introduction of our speaker, Professor Mark Sandberg.
We are very thrilled and honored to welcome Professor Mark Sandberg to the Commonweal. Professor Sandberg holds a double appointment in Scandinavian Studies and Film and Media at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a member of the International Ibsen Committee and currently the president of the Ibsen Society of America. Please welcome Mark Sandberg.
Thanks for that introduction, Hal. I really want to thank the Ibsen Fest for inviting me to attend and present some remarks about Ibsen and his play Brunt today. It's a real pleasure for me to be here in Lanesboro, in part because it's a place I've been hearing about from my Ibsen colleagues for years. Several of them have been invited here to present lectures, and they've always mentioned the warm reception that they've received here. And they told me that if I was ever invited, I should jump at the chance, so here I am. It's not curiosity about life on the prairie that brings me here necessarily, though some of my bi-coastal colleagues at Berkeley might look at it that way. I grew up in a suburb of St. Paul, so I come from Minnesota and I still have family here. So even though I've spent over my half of my life in California, I remember Minnesota very well. As I was calculating just how long I've been out west, I realized it was almost as long as Ibsen spent abroad on the European continent after leaving Norway. So he spent 27 years in Italy and Germany between 1864 and 1891. He wrote most of his famous plays while he was abroad. And almost all of his plays deal with small town life in Norway. So he builds in this kind of double perspective the whole time. Since California has a Mediterranean climate and Minnesota has a Norwegian one, maybe that gives me some special empathy for Ibsen's experience in strongly contrasting places, the homeland of his youth and the new places he experienced when he was abroad. Just to give a stark example of this is one of my favorite examples. This is the scene from the Amalfi Coast in southern Italy, where Ibsen wrote the play A Doll's House. And he was looking out over palm trees and lemon trees while thinking about entrapment in a small, stuffy, bourgeois Norwegian interior back home. For whatever reason, I discovered when I visited this hotel here, Richard Wagner also wrote his opera Parsifal there. So how that can happen that two gloomy Northern Europeans could go to this place with a killer view and the whole time think about life back home, that's part of the mystery that I think is so interesting about Ibsen. That's the productive tension in his work. So as he looked back on Norway from abroad, he was merciless in his criticism of small-mindedness, especially when he discovered it in his fellow countrymen, and he spent the greater part of his career dissecting that kind of small-mindedness. So I should clear something right up at this point, right away, because I'm depending on my sister for a ride back to the Twin Cities tomorrow morning. I have fonder feelings about Minnesota than Ibsen had about Norway. And so that's where the personal analogy breaks down a little bit, but I still try to get a little bit of the empathy for what this must have been like. Sometimes I wonder, how did I end up in California so far away from how everything started? And that was definitely part of Ibsen's transforming experience, I think. Ibsen did indeed claim at one point that Norway was not a good country to have as a fatherland. And he once famously described the trip from Norway to Denmark and on to Europe as emerging from a long, dark tunnel into the light. And so when Ibsen left Norway at age 36, his departure often gets characterized as an exile, maybe because that fits our preconceived notions of the uncompromising romantic artist who has become bigger and more cosmopolitan than his origins. But Ibsen was not, in fact, forced to leave Norway. There was nothing preventing him from returning. His travels actually began as a one-year government-supported study trip to Italy. So this is really a study abroad trip gone bad in a way, 27 years later. What began as a short sort of familiarization with the culture of Europe ended up as a conscious choice to stay away, a choice that lasted until 1891 when he returned to Norway for the last 15 years of his life. The story of why he remained abroad has a lot to do with the genesis of the play that's being staged here at the Ibsenfest this weekend. Brandt was written the summer after Ibsen first arrived in Italy in 1864. When he left Norway in late April of that year, Denmark had just suffered a decisive defeat in its war with Prussia over possession of the Schleswig area of southern Jutland. Ibsen had up to that point been a patriotic Norwegian and also an ardent pan-Scandinavian supporter of a wider cultural alliance in the north, and his Nordic identity was really important to him in his early years and in his early plays. So when the governments of Norway and Sweden decided not to come to Denmark's aid in the War of 1864, in effect stranding the Danes and leaving them to be defeated by a far more numerous foe, Ibsen was outraged at his countrymen for what he saw as a cowardly compromise of important pan-Scandinavian ideals, however politically pragmatic that decision might have been for the countries involved. As he traveled south through Berlin in early May of that year, he bitterly witnessed a German victory parade from one of the most decisive battles in which they showed off and spit into the Danish cannons that were being taken down the streets of Berlin. He was sitting there watching as an observer of all of this. Later that year, as he settled into his new life in Rome, he received news of Denmark's final defeat in October of 1864, and this was a really crucial turn in Scandinavian history since it signaled the end of any real Danish military influence in Europe. Danish had been a major power in the early modern period. And in Ibsen's mind, the blame lay mainly with his fellow Scandinavians who were not principled enough to fight for their professed ideals. There was just a handful of Norwegians and Swedes who volunteered for the army to go help the Danes. So this is the idea that he was turning over and over in his mind throughout that winter and into the following summer of 1865. And at one point he said that the humiliation of it all was growing like an embryo in him the whole time. So 1 year after arriving, in July of 1865, he reportedly had a powerful experience in St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome that provided a second strong impulse in the formation of Brandt. He described his impressions to his fellow Norwegian author Bjørnstjerne Bjørnson in a letter from September of that year while he was in the midst of working intensely on the play. He reports the following about his experience in the cathedral, and there I magically translated this into English for you. There, a powerful and clear form for what I wanted to say suddenly became obvious to me. Now I have thrown out what I have tortured myself with for a year without making any progress, and in the middle of July started something new that moved forward in a way I have never experienced before. New in the sense that I began to write it then, but the material and the mood has oppressed me since the many unpleasant events at home brought me to look inside myself and our life there and to think about things that before have passed me by without much of a thought and that I have never dealt with seriously. There have been several interpretations of what this experience in St. Peter's that day meant for Ibsen. One biographer, Michael Meyer, puts the interpretive weight on the phrase powerful and clear form and imagines Ibsen discovering Michelangelo's willingness to break all the rules and to exceed existing aesthetic norms, and then going on to write Brandt and depicting this titanic, uncompromising main character who would make Michelangelo proud. So Meyer writes, quote, "It is significant that his revelation of how the play should shape itself had come to him in St. Peter's under Michelangelo's dome. Brandt is a mighty cathedral of a play, and Brandt's God, young and strong like Hercules, is an exact description of Christ as painted by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel." So here is maybe what Ibsen was reacting to. This is, of course, in the Sistine Chapel and not in St. Peter's. But what Meyer has in mind is a visual inspiration, I think, from The Last Judgment that leads Ibsen to create his equally unswerving character. If I felt that Ibsen had ended up writing a play with an unambiguous endorsement of an all-or-nothing character, I might be more persuaded by Meyer's claim, but there are many reasons to view the preacher Brandt with a combination of astonishment and horror. Astonishment at the sheer force of his will, and horror at what he is willing to sacrifice for a cause, his home, his mother, his child, his wife, among other things. If, on the one hand, Ibsen imagined the character as a strong antidote to the wishy-washiness of his countrymen during the 1864 war, as a fantasy of absolute commitment and what it would look like, on the other, he does not hold back on depicting the human costs that come with taking extreme positions. Although the character Brandt never hesitates, I think that Ibsen, the writer, does. Once the character was formed in his mind, Ibsen took a step back as well, as he often did, and thought of him as a character experiment. What if one really were willing to give up everything human for a cause? And then we watched that play out in the character. You might say the same thing about Dr. Stockman in Enemy of the People. There's kind of support for this character almost all the way through the play, and then you can sense the step back at one point where Ibsen starts to be more critical of the idealist and the cause. If we return to Ibsen's letter about the experience in St. Peter, we can see traces of some collateral effects of this encounter with Michelangelo, some that I find a little bit more interesting. As Ibsen continues past the comment about the powerful and clear form, he conveys the kind of perspective that is typical after powerful encounters with foreign cultures. The home culture suddenly looks different. It rebounds back on where you came from. The disillusionment Ibsen felt in light of the Danish defeat had plagued his writing efforts all winter long. His formerly positive national feelings and allegiances had died, but nothing had really replaced them. I can imagine that the encounter with the foreign culture's more powerful art in one of its most powerful architectural spaces could have been a strongly decentering experience. Here was something coherent, strong, and clear, the antithesis of what he perceived to be a lack of will at home. But it's also interesting that Michelangelo's art gets him thinking, quote, about things that before have passed me by without much of a thought, end quote. In other words, he now had a position outside the home culture from which he could write, and the work on the play went more quickly than he had ever experienced before. So there is a word in the Norwegian original of this letter that is not easily translated, and I'm showing the text again because I have the suspicion there might be somebody else in this room who can read Norwegian. I can't make that assumption in California, so I want to take advantage of it while I'm here. But just in case your once near perfect Norwegian skills have, you know, atrophied a little bit, I'll explain things as we go along. The word in question is one that I've translated as unpleasant when I read the English translation. In Norwegian, the original word is uhyggelig, which is a real difficult word to translate. In my book on Ibsen, I spend a lot of time explaining the way this term gets used by Ibsen and his contemporaries because I find it key to Ibsen's thinking about the idea of home and how he wants to unsettle that idea in both a literal and a metaphoric sense. The term's opposite, hyggelig, is a very useful and common word in Norwegian that describes feelings of comfort, ease, belonging, pleasure. It describes evenings spent with friends or family, candlelight, warmth, atmosphere, coziness. All of these things are in the orbit of the word hyggelig. Uhyggelig, in contrast, generally describes unpleasure, unease, something disturbing or unnerving. It can refer to everything from a vague sense of dread to outright uncanny experiences. I won't bore you with the book-length argument here, though I know we academics are famous for doing that. We love our books, especially when they are our own. But the short version is this. After Ibsen left Norway, he became very suspicious of house and home and everything cozy that goes along with it. he started to see a virtue in displacement because of what it allowed him to see. Things that are disturbing and cause unease, he came to believe, are valuable for art. They shake people out of the worldview that they were born into. They help the individual detach him or herself from the limiting perspectives of the familiar. And the word familiar, of course, has the word family at the core of it. So in Ibsen's letter to Bjørnson, one can see a hint of that decentering process beginning with the disturbing or uhyggelige events that took place back home around the 1864 war, and then the subsequent thinking throughout the year about things that before have passed me by without much of a thought. These are things that before would have been taken as assumptions. Suddenly, it seems, Ibsen could see his home culture clearly from the outside. He had been put into a productive position of unease. There had been a hint of that perspective already in a poem that Ibsen had published 5 years earlier in 1860. In this poem, the poetic I, the voice of the poem, describes the process of detachment from the cares of domestic life in favor of a wilder, freer life as a hunter on a mountain plateau, where he is taught to be tough, independent, and indifferent to sentiment by another hunter that he meets up there. The poem is called On the Heights, or På Vidderne. The poem has usually been read as a sort of manifesto of sorts for Ibsen, but it also really decenters the usual expected feelings about house and home and the whole complex of ideas that attach to domestic life. Chief among them in this poem are details like the comforts of fur covers and mothers singing to children with cats curled up at the foot of the bed. In short, warmth, security, and coziness. So that's how this starts out. The narrator's hunter mentor, this person he meets up on the heights, scorns such pleasures and teaches resistance quite specifically to these soft temptations of the home. And this culminates on a Christmas Eve as the poem's narrator looks down on the valley below and is momentarily seized by a longing for an imperfectly remembered coziness as he hears the church bells ring in the holiday. So this is what I have quoted here. They ushered in solemn Christmas time with the old familiar bells. There is a light behind my neighbor's gate, and from my mother's cottage proceeds a glow that strangely charms and entices me. Home, with all its impoverished life, became a saga of rich images. Up here lay the mountain range, vast and rigid. Down there I had a mother and wife. It is no surprise that I would yearn for them. The setting viewed from the heights is not just familiar in the family sense, but literally homey. The adjective describing the familiar bells in Norwegian is exactly that, hjemlig. Their sound entices the narrator to ignore the harsh memories of scarcity, hunger, and need that actually marked his childhood, and to imagine instead on this Christmas Eve an idealized home of comfort and ease. So at this moment, his strange hunter companion breaks the spell with a scornful remark and says, "It looks like my young friend is moved. Well, well, the homey cottage." With the help of this sudden deflation, the poem's narrator quickly recovers his hardened composure. "Once again I stood there with arm of steel and felt that I was the strong one. The breeze of the mountains cooled my breast. Never again will it stir up in warmth for a blinking Christmas beacon." The poem then takes a horrifying turn at the beckoning light, the beacon from the narrator's homey cottage, because it reveals itself to be a fire, not a cozy curl of smoke from a fire in the chimney or something like that. And it transforms itself very quickly into the opposite. The entire cottage is burning down. The light and the curling smoke transform themselves from these cozy, typical signs of coziness into their opposite, the total destruction of the narrator's childhood home and the death of his mother and his wife. But as the poem's narrator cries out in sorrow, we get these verses from his companion. "But the hunter comforted him, 'Why the fuss? After all, it's merely the old house burning up with the Christmas beer and the cat.' With an awful, unsettling turn of perspective, the mentor urges his pupil to look at the scene down below precisely as a scene, framing it with his hands in a certain way. to get the perspective right, seen from that angle, it is in fact just an old house from that distance. Of course, it's more than that. The narrator's mother and wife perish in the flames. His last connection to childhood is destroyed. Finally, though, the narrator is able to see the scene in the same way as his hunter companion, as the angels carry his mother's soul up to the Christmas Eve joy in the heavens. The narrator is able to appreciate her journey in an aesthetic way. But it can't be denied that there was quite an effect in the double lighting of the night sky. So the poem's complexity derives from the splitting of the hunter position into two voices, one a hardened mentor and the other a kind of wavering apprentice who hasn't yet internalized the lesson. Without that split, the poem would present a simple contrast between low and high, between home and away, between family ties and individual freedom. But instead, there are hints of a past vulnerability in the mysterious hunter, and the training of the poem's narrator in the ways of callous independence is further described as a theft of his will. So there's lots of things that are kind of equivocal here. Enticed on both sides, though, the narrator wavers for most of the poem between home and independence without really landing with both feet in either camp. This, I would suggest, is the kind of double perspective that only gets intensified after Ibsen leaves Norway. He is increasingly the poet on the foreign heights, looking from distance on his home culture below and steeling himself to make use of it aesthetically, to shape his experience into plays about life on the inside of that culture. As he shapes each character, it's as if he too is sort of putting up his hand to make the frame and to see the culture through that distance. So is there a benefit in doing this? Yes, one can maybe see more clearly without sentiment. Is there a cost? Yes, one gives up former attachments to comfort, home, family, and security. So I'm going to turn to the play now, to Brandt, and suggest how these same themes play themselves out. But first, I want to emphasize that its connection to this kind of earlier poetry is important because the play Brandt was not originally intended to be staged. And it was, in fact, first and foremost, a poem, a very long poem. It had actually begun as an epic poem with a different form in the summer of 1864, and he actually worked on this epic Brandt all the way through the year before giving it up, the turning point being this moment in St. Peter's. That seemed to shift the form in the direction of drama, and he turned it into dramatic poem, as he called it, and this allowed him to make clearer characters with sharper conflict and also to turn to a more scenic logic all the way through. An epic poem often has more continuity to it. A dramatic poem can work with scenes in a different way. So this is what he published in March of 1866 to great acclaim through Scandinavia. This is the work that established him as one of the foremost Scandinavian authors. It was obviously because it was in Norwegian verse. It wasn't as easy to travel to other countries, not nearly as easy as the prose plays could be translated later on. And so this is mainly forming a very strong Scandinavian reputation for Ibsen. It's not performed very often at all, so that makes this a real treat here to be able to see it on stage in the adaptation that'll be shown here. So for those of you who haven't read or seen the play, let me give you a brief synopsis. It opens with a strangely intense itinerant preacher named Brandt, who is returning to his home district in Norway. It both is and is not a homecoming at the same time, because Brandt is actually quite indifferent to this place of origin. His main purpose in traveling through the area is to preach a gospel of all or nothing, which is his motto throughout, to shake his former hometown out of their complacency and mediocrity. His charisma attracts the attention of a young woman named Agnes, who is attracted by his idealism and leaves her fiancé Einar to follow Brandt and eventually to marry him. They have a child, but as we all know, family life is hard to reconcile with all or nothing, and Brandt is really quite severe in his requirements. Both his wife and his child die as an indirect result of his refusal to compromise. He remains in the area. The people choose him as their pastor, and he embarks on a massive building project, a church that will house the ideal that he imagines, an entire community devoted to the idea of ultimate sacrifice. When that project also disappoints him, as projects often do, the crowd eventually turns on him for economic reasons, and he abandons them up into the mountain, and in a final tableau, he is buried by an avalanche, and a voice comes at the end saying in Latin, "God is love." So this is the trajectory of the play. Given that this is a play that imagines a homeless character returning home, it is obvious how it fits Ibsen's own situation as a newly displaced Norwegian abroad. He imagines a character that allows him vicariously to return to the place he left and to say everything he wants to say to his home culture. In the figure of Brandt, we're dealing with a character who begins the drama already in a state of complete detachment from home, since he is wandering the countryside. The play opens with this kind of accidental discovery that, oh, I guess this is the district I grew up in. We first encounter Brandt on the road, and he tells the character Einar that although he knows that he is close to his home village, he will only pass through and beyond it. He claims, like the rabbit under the forest spruce, I have my house sometimes here, sometimes there. This creates a link between the two gypsy characters in the poem, Gerd and the old woman at the end of the fourth act, who says something similar. We shall travel, we shall wander, house and home are for the rest of you. The Ibsen scholar Toril Moy sees a clear parallel between the itinerant preacher Brandt and the gypsy girl, calling Gerd and Brandt symbolic siblings for this very reason. Both are mobile characters. As the play begins, we are confronted with the idea that Brandt might in fact be the type to regard his own situation as home free rather than homeless. And that's maybe worth explaining a bit. Just to call something homeless inscribes the idea of homeless as the norm and as the default position. And many avant-garde artists throughout the 20th century would call that proposition into question. And they would see being away from home as being free of home, as being liberated from home and all of its constraints, that put a positive value on that. So the conflict between homeless and home free is very pitched in Ibsen, I would say, all the way through. Other people see that line as saying, you know, Brandt was doing everything to offer up for this God, and the God responds by saying, sacrifice accepted. So there's a kind of ambiguity to that in some ways that I think is exactly Ibsen's position toward the character, that he starts with a very strong idea, and then almost always as he's working through drafts, he starts building in more structures of doubt and more, you know, sort of self-critical examination of it. So I think it makes sense to think of him more as an experiment in a character position than it does to say, well, does he endorse him or not?
Thank you for listening to Culture Click. More information on Ibsenfest can be found online at ibsenfest.org.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.